Good morning and welcome to the Education Committee to order. Today is Monday, the 13th, 2023. Let the record reflect that it is 08 o'clock. Representative McKay. Today we are present here with Representative Prox, Representative McCormick, Representative Tom McKay, Representative Rebecca Hemshute, Representative Ruffridge, and let's see here, and myself, Representative Allard. I would like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to silence or turn off your cell phones. The staff will be assisting us today are Linda Jensen with House Records. Welcome, Linda. I've got a new one here. Hold on. Doug Bridgets. Did I say that correctly? Thank you. And with the LIO and Lindsay Kosser, House Committee Aide. We have four bills today on the agenda. We'll be starting off with the second hearing of HB 69. Reclassification of first-class cities. We will be doing a Q&A and then opening up for public testimony. So I'd like to invite Representative Mike Kronk to the table, please. Welcome, Representative Kronk. Can you please put your name on the record and your staffer? I apologize. I have forgotten your... Thank you. If you guys could put your name on the record, that would be great. And then you can proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mike Kronk, District 36.
Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kronk.
Yeah, we are here today for our bill HB 69, which allows a community to reclassify from a one city to a two city. The purpose of combining a school district with another school district.
Is that all you have, Representative Kronk?
You like to keep things short and sweet.
Representative McKay, we might get out of here very quick.
I'm delighted.
Do we have any questions? We do. Go ahead, Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, which communities would this apply to right now?
Right now, this would affect the city of Tanana.
Through the chair.
Yes.
No other communities in the state, just one right now.
Correct.
You could do a follow-up?
Thank you. Are there other cities forthcoming that we can foresee are headed in that direction, to your knowledge?
Dave Stancliffe for Representative Kronk. There are four cities at present in the state that fall before, that are first class, that fall below the 400 person minimum that you have to become a first class city. No other cities have indicated that they're unhappy or wish to make any changes. This bill is not mandatory. It simply allows Tanana the ability, if they want to make the change, to do so. But yes, other communities, if they're below 400, could in fact make the change if the community votes to do so.
Thank you. I just wanted to recognize that Representative Story is right. Thank you. At 8:04. Go ahead, Representative Hemshute.
So why does Tanana want this?
Well, the school is not supported well enough by the government because the government is under stress, having fallen to 241 people from a high of over 2,000 at one time. And so the district is working already with the larger school district. We have a letter of support from the mayor and the Yukon Koyukuk School District saying this would be the best thing for the kids. But ultimately, the community has to decide. This isn't something we're doing for them. This is simply giving them an option.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Prox, did you have a question?
I did. This reclassifies Tanana to a second-class city. Would they not still be required for the local tax contribution?
No, that changes when you go from first to second class, and that's one of the reasons they're looking for this opportunity to consider. And some of these borough questions and the LBC, we've contacted them. They said whatever the legislature decides is what they'll live with. They're quasi-judicial, and they're not regularly testifying ever before the legislative committee. So they have not issued an opinion one way or the other. Community and regional affairs will see this bill next, and we're thinking that if there are any governmental issues, the educational issues here are pretty plain before the committee.
Are there any other questions from the Kenny representative on our story?
Thank you, Chair Allard. Through the chair and the story, I was late to the beginning of your presentation. We heard this last year, and I can see the need for it, and I'm fine with that. But my question is, we can already do this through statute. That's my understanding, that we can already do this through statute. It involves a more administrative process, and they might not have the capacity to do that. But my understanding was that it could be changed through statute.
Representative Kronk, would you like to respond?
I would. Thank you for that question. We did do this last year with Rampart. We flipped school district, but the caveat here is Tanana is a class one city, and that is what stops this from making that process happen. So they have to drop to a class two city, then we can submit the bill to transfer Tanana City Schools into the YK School District like we did Rampart last year. So this is our first step we have to get done in order to complete this step.
Thank you. Are there Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. There are other services provided by first class cities, potentially police, utilities, etc.
And just quickly, I want to remind everybody to go through the chair. Go ahead, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Do those services, I would guess they're not being provided effectively now, but do they have some provision, other things that need to be taken care of for the other services that might be provided by the city?
The answer to that is the local community will have to decide, and they will do that under this bill by a majority vote. We're not familiar intimately with the local business and what's happening locally in Tanana. We've just been advised they're under duress, difficulty in getting a quorum even for council votes. The city is basically failing under the first class status is what we're told. We can't verify that to you. So we're anticipating they will use this option, but we don't know. You're just giving them the option if they want to do it.
Are there any questions further from the committee? Just a brief at ease. Thank you. Public testimony that would like to come forward that's in this room today. Is there anybody online who would like to testify for public testimony? Okay. Wow. I think that's all we have for today.
Madam Chair, may I ask another question?
You may. Go ahead, Representative Story.
And again, I'm sorry because this might have been covered when I was not here, and I don't remember from our first hearing, but I don't believe have we heard from the school district and what is their thoughts on this matter? If you could remind me if that's been said. Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Representative Story. Both school districts are in agreement here. Right now, the Tanana City School is actually under a contract with the Yukon Koyukuk School District, so they're basically functioning under them. Some of the highlights this year, Tanana has similar language and culture activities and resources. This will offer a lot of savings, you know, combining administration and stuff. You can eliminate a bunch of positions. This will allow Tanana City to be part of their school board. So there's a lot of the benefits of having this in here is it basically the best thing for this is the best thing for the students of Tanana. It's going to give them a lot more opportunities with what the, you know, Yukon Koyukuk provides as a school district. So this is a real benefit to the community and the students. So that's the purpose of this bill.
All right. Okay. Thank you. So we see no further public testimony, so I'm going to gavel out of that. And we're going to continue on and see no one in the room or online. I will now close the public testimony. There is an amendment deadline set for, public testimony for HB 69. There is an amendment deadline set for Wednesday, March 15th at 3 p.m. for HB 69. We will hold HB 69 and revisit it during the meeting on Friday, March 17th, 2023. And I'm going to have a brief at ease. I'll be moving to the next agenda item and an introduction to HB 106, teacher recruitment, lump sum payment, followed by an introduction to HB 105, sex reproduction education. I would like to invite Susan McKenzie, Director of Innovation and Education Excellence, to the table, please. Welcome, and if you could please put your name on the table or your name on the record for the presentation.
Good morning, Chair Allard. My name is Susie McKenzie. I'm the Director of Innovation and Education Excellence for the Department of Education and Early Development. This morning, we want to talk about teacher incentive or the teacher bonus bill. And this bill addresses Alaska Education Challenge Priority Number 4 to prepare, attract, and retain effective education professionals. We know that teachers have a tremendous impact on student achievement. We have approximately 7,300 teachers working in our Alaska public schools. Teacher stability and effectiveness are essential components of student achievement. As a reminder, here are a few facts regarding teacher retention and recruitment in Alaska. We have an increased number of first day school vacancies. In 2023, we had roughly 394 vacancies the first day of school, compared to 155 vacancies in 2019. In Alaska, most of our teachers are recruited from the lower 48. We have seen an increasing number of teachers filling positions from out of state. In 2018, we had about 460 teachers coming to us from out of state, and that increased to about 1,050 in 2023. We have also issued a number of emergency licensures. Transfers are up. From 2018, we had 897 transfers. To 2023, we had over 1,000. We also know that about 22% of our teachers turn over annually. Turnover rate is higher in rural remote areas. As you may recall, the governor ordered a task force to examine teacher retention and recruitment back in 2020. In a report by a 30-member Alaska Working Group, a teacher retention and recruitment action plan report was presented in April of 2021, and it identified some of the root causes, and using a survey and also qualitative supplemental study of written comments from teachers that held active certifications in Alaska at that time. From the survey, salary ranked number one. House Bill 106 proposes to address the highest ranked finding of the report by implementing the following: 3 years of incentive payments for eligible teachers of about $58 million each year from fiscal year 25 through 27 for work that was completed in fiscal year 24, 25, and 26. So basically, after a teacher had worked full time in a year, the next fiscal year, that funding, those bonuses would occur. For purposes of this bill, a full-time school district classroom teacher is defined as someone who holds a teacher certificate issued under AS 14.20 and provides instruction for a roster of students for at least 60% of the school day, or is assigned to monitor students' work and progress under AS 14.03 300, which would include correspondence. The definition of a teacher is slightly different for correspondence because of the way instruction and support is delivered. Tiered incentives would be implemented based on the district size and location. The bill discusses three tiers that Deborah Riddle will go over in the sectional analysis. This would be considered a pilot, and data would be taken regarding the effect it has on teacher retention and recruitment, as well as correlation with student achievement. I will now turn this over to Division's Operation Manager, Deborah Riddle, to review the sectional analysis and fiscal notes of House Bill 106.
Thanks for the record. My name is Deborah Riddle, Division Operations Manager for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. HB 106 is a teacher recruitment lump sum payment bill. The Section 1 amends uncodified law by adding a new section that establishes a program that would pay certificated full-time teachers with a lump sum payment on or around July 1, 2024, July 1, 2025, and July 1, 2026. The payment of the lump sum appropriation is contingent on appropriations made for this purpose in the fiscal years FY 2025, FY 2026, and FY 2027. The bill limits the payment of the full-time teachers assigned to a classroom teaching assignment and specifically excludes temporary, substitute, or assistant teachers. To be eligible for payment, a teacher must occupy a teaching position for the entire school year immediately preceding the date of payment. In addition to be eligible for payment, teachers would be required to submit an application to school, and school districts would be responsible for certifying these applications. The Department of Education and Early Development would develop an application, and it would be due no later than the last day of school for the eligible school year. Once the application and certification requirements are met, DEED would grant school districts funding to pay the retention and recruitment incentives as a lump sum payment to eligible teachers. The bill also considers all lump sum payments compensation for the purposes of the Teachers Retirement System, TRS. Finally, DEED may adopt regulations necessary to carry out the purposes of this bill. In Section 2, the bill is effective July 1, 2023.
Thank you. Does that conclude your brief?
It does. You have the breakdown in your notes. Was it in the sectional analysis? Back one page.
So in considering the three tiers, through the chair, this is Director McKenzie, sorry. Considering the bill, the three tiers, the larger more urban areas would receive $5,000 if they met the requirements laid out in the bill. That includes five districts. It's approximately 5,000 teachers, and that cost would be $24,825,000. DEED looked at the historical performance data over a two-year period as well as geographic location making decisions about how to break out the tiers. Tier two, or the second tier, would be $10,000, and that's more rural districts. In that list, there would be 24 districts. It includes approximately 1,100 teachers and approximately $9,520,000. It's a mix of small single-site and borough districts, some mid-sized city and borough districts, as well as some small and mid-sized REAA districts. Most are on the road system and considered low-performing based on the average index score that's done through our ESSA plan, Every Student Succeeds Act plan. Sorry about that acronym. And then finally, the last tier is more rural remote. That would be $15,000. The list in this part is of 25 districts. It includes about 1,300 teachers. It's approximately $17,175,000. And it includes small single-site and borough districts and mid-size and small REAAs, as well as some large REAAs and similar borough districts, mostly off the road system and low-performing based on the average index score. So it was a combination of location, size, and index score to make divisions about the tiers.
Thank you, Ms. McKenzie. Is that all for your presentation today on HB 106?
Information.
Excuse me?
Through the chair, would you like the fiscal note information as well?
You can. We can also hold off on that until we come back, but if you'd like to present the fiscal note, you can.
That would be up to you guys.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the fiscal note it has the $51 million for the payout for the teachers, but it also would include a position, a long-term non-permanent position in the FY 2024 to implement the program and develop the regulations for the application. That would be an education associate, range 17, which would be $110,000 annually in personal services cost. There would be the chargebacks for $10,100, as well as a one-time $5,000 fee for the equipment and supplies, and then $6,000 one-time fee for the regulation costs.
Thank you. All right. Now, does that conclude the presentation for HB 106? Okay, thank you. We will hold HB 106 and revisit it during a meeting to be determined in the future. We will now be moving forward with the introduction to HB 105. I would like to ask Deb Riddle, please. Not on this one. Operation Manager, Innovation of Education Excellence, to join Ms. McKenzie at the table, please. All right. Welcome, and please put your names back on the record.
Chair Allard, my name is Susie McKenzie. I'm currently serving as the Director of Innovation and Education Excellence for Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. The fifth priority of the Alaska Education Challenge is to improve the safety and well-being of students through school partnerships with families, communities, and tribes. We address safety and well-being in many ways. There are e-learning courses offered that involve health and safety. We have an initiative for positive behavior intervention and supports that we currently are involved with. We also have the trauma-engaged framework that probably most of you have heard about. And in all of these, there is family partnership and family input as part of these initiatives. Focusing on school partnerships with families, communities, and tribes, research says that students whose parents stay involved in school have better attendance, behavior, and get better grades, demonstrate better social skills, and adapt better to school. In schools today, parent engagement is required for student participation in several ways. In special education, it requires parent permission to assess. It requires parent permission to involve a child in a special education program, as well as be part of an individual education plan formation. For field trips, most schools require parent permission in order to attend a field trip. In the Alaska Reads Act, it requires parent involvement, parent engagement. It's very specific. Handing out medications at school requires parent permission. In many ways, we have parent permission, involvement, and engagement at school. The importance of parent rights has been established through the Parent Rights and Responsibilities Act of 1995 by the 104th Congress. It prohibits federal, state, or local government, or any official of such government, from interfering with or usurping the right of a parent to govern the upbringing of a child of the parent. In 2016, there was a passage of the Alaska Parent Rights Bill. It was the adoption of school board policies to promote the involvement of parents in the school district's education programming, and it included recognizing the authority of a parent and allowing a parent to object and withdraw the child from an activity, class, or program. House Bill 105 proposes to affirm and expand Alaska parental rights and strengthens the partnership between parents and school by meaningful notice and consent requirements. I will now turn this over to Division Operations Manager Deborah Riddle to review the sectional analysis and fiscal notes of House Bill 105.
Okay. Through the chair, my name is Deborah Riddle, Division Operations Manager for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. I'll go ahead and read the sectional analysis for this bill. In Section 1, AS 1403016, a parent's right to direct the education of the parent's child, in subsection A3, it's adding a list of parental rights regarding the student's participation in activities and classes that include content involving gender. This subsection also adds an opt-in provision stating that parents need to provide written permission for their students to participate in the activity or class. Additional language is added under subsection A7 that a parent must provide written permission before a name or pronoun may be changed in the student records, and under Section A8 that the parent must also be notified in writing of legal remedies available to them. Section 2 amends AS 1403016D by adding the definition of gender identity as the internal sense of being either male or female or something else, which may or may not correspond with the individual's biological sex. Section 3, it adds two new subsections. Subsection E states that the parent may file civil action against a school district who violates a policy or procedure adopted under subsection A of this section. Subsection F states that a school district that knowingly or recklessly violates a policy or procedure under subsection A of this section is liable for not less than $5,000 in civil penalties and may be liable for damages upon knowing of a violation established by a clear and convincing evidence. In subsection 4, access to AS 1403115, access to school records by parent, foster parent, or guardian, by adding a language that prohibits school districts or regional education attendance areas from selectively withholding information regarding a child's physical, mental, or medical or mental health from a parent or foster parent or guardian, unless the information may result in child abuse or neglect. Section 5, AS 1430361, sex education, human reproduction education, and human sexuality education, by adding two new subsections. Subsection E states that a class or program involving sex education, human reproduction education, and human sexuality education requires parental notice and permission. Subsection F states that these topics may not be attended by a child before grade 4, except as provided by AS 1430355, sexual abuse and sexual assault awareness and prevention. Section 6 amends AS 1433120, a parent's right to direct the education of the parent's child, by adding a list of procedures required by school districts and regional education attendance areas on addressing the physical safety and privacy of students in locker rooms and restrooms, the separation of students by biological sex, access to single occupant facilities, or other safety and privacy protocols as required. Section 17 repeals Section AS 1403016, a parent's right to direct the education of a parent's child, and subsection D2, which further defines human reproduction and sexual matters, to not include sexual assault and the prevention training under AS 1430355. Section 8 makes this bill effective on July 1st, 2023, and the fiscal note will be $6,000 to get regulations in place.
Thank you, Ms. Riddle. And it looks like we have Ms. Stewart on the phone that is going to be part of your presentation.
Through the chair, I believe there are two people for invited public testimony.
Okay.
Would be Christine Google and Lisa Stewart.
Okay, it looks like we only have Ms. Stewart on the line right now. So if we can go ahead and go with her. Ms. Stewart, would you like to put your name on the record, please?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lisa Stewart. Thanks for this opportunity to testify in favor of the amendments to House Bill 105, ensuring parent rights and transparency in the education of our youth. I'll be brief, but it's a goal of mine to paint a little bit of a picture of who I am and my passion for this important work and its relevance to House Bill 105. I know now as an adult, not so much as a child, that my experiences have shaped my beliefs about who I am. Family influence runs deep to the core of who we are. Our experiences form our beliefs about ourselves and the world around us, and most certainly may influence life choices, including but not limited to possibly choosing a mate, a career, a lifestyle, and much more. I come from a family of storytellers. This is cultural. So I will attempt to make some points through a story. My name is Lisa Stewart. I was the fourth child in a family of six kids born to Stan and Ginger, Thunder Hawk, South Dakota. I'm also a twin. My father was born on Standing Rock Indian Reservation, a Lakota Sioux. My mother of German and Irish ascent. My father, a conservative Protestant, my mother, a Catholic Democrat. Diversity was celebrated and respected in my home. Respect was modeled and learned through examples from my parents. I learned to care for and respect my elders as my grandmother, Unchi, lived with us most of my years growing up. As a result of this model, I cared for my own parents before they passed. Being a middle child in a large family taught me many things: responsibility, self-reliance, organization, resilience, a strong work ethic, to name a few. These traits came from my first teachers, my parents. I'm the daughter of a mortician. I grew up in a funeral home. Although not easy at times, pretty awkward, I learned service to others. I learned empathy, nurturing, how to show respect and reverence. I learned how to provide support at the most difficult time in a person's life, the death of a loved one. These virtues are my strengths, and they came from my parents. I'm a wife, a daughter, a sister, an aunt, a twin, a mother of two sons, a stepmother, a mother-in-law, a daughter-in-law, a grandmother of three, a teacher, a counselor, a friend, a Christian, and much more. This is who I am. This is my identity. I've worked as an educator for more than 30 years, quite a bit more, in fact, in many different capacities. I earned a two-year certificate in early childhood growth and development in a vocational school during high school. I've worked as a paraprofessional, a classroom teacher in both elementary and middle school. I've worked as a counselor, a behavior support coordinator for my district. I've worked in administration, providing training to superintendents, principals, teachers, paraprofessionals, substitutes, bus drivers, and more. I took on additional work contracts in remote Alaska, including Bristol Bay Borough School District, Lower Kuskokwim, Selawik, Kotzebue, Giganak, to name a few, where I provided professional development in both math instruction and teacher evaluation. I'm proud of mentoring 60 teachers over a five-year period for the Alaska State Mentor Project. I've written suicide prevention curriculum in Juneau, worked on a revision of professional teacher standards, and worked collaboratively on the writing of our state cultural standards. I've designed and taught many graduate-level classes for UAA. I was honored to travel to Washington, D.C. to receive the Presidential Teacher of Excellence in Math and Science in 2001. I retired in 2018 after working closely with my district's principals and coordinating social-emotional learning, SEL. I'm not particularly proud of how SEL, like academic curriculum, has been used as a vessel for teaching developmentally inappropriate and or sexually sensitive content to our youth. Just this February, last month, in fact, I finished teaching a five-week parenting class in the Matsu District where I currently work as a counselor half-time. The parents were amazing. They were parents who recognized they needed some support for structuring their children to be successful. I'm proud to have learned from these parents in return. I believe my vast experiences in education qualifies me to speak with some knowledge on the amendments to House Bill 105, in particular, my experiences working with families. Working with parents is one of the eight professional teaching standards. These eight teaching standards are designed from research on best practices in teaching. Working with parents is crucial. Our parents are our students' first teachers, and working collaboratively with them can support moving a student at an accelerated pace academically, socially, and with the skills necessary for work, community, and a productive, happy life. Transparency in education is necessary for this collaboration. The relationship needs to be built on trust, and our students' parents need to feel valued for their expertise on their children. This does not always mean we agree, but this is their child, and we will learn about the family and child when we care enough to listen to both concerns and successes. I'm no stranger to tough kids or tough parents. I've stood beside new teachers and encouraged them to lean in and to listen to parent concerns. This desire to work together and the validating of parents has always worked out for the best for those students, their families, and yes, even the teachers. I've learned it is not about me and my feelings. It is about what is best for the child. Parental involvement impacts student success, and their involvement should be embraced and valued, not seen as a threat. Working with our parents should guide our work for the purpose of learning about our students. Remember professional teaching standards, working with parents. Parent involvement initiatives are increasing nationwide, not just in Alaska. We should not be surprised that Alaskans are becoming more involved in the content and quality of instruction their children are getting. Families have been through a lot. Parents were challenged to become teachers, tutors, technologists almost overnight with a pandemic. Many parents were juggling multiple kids at home with individual expectations, along with the challenge of managing their own work schedules and challenges with child care, etc. Parent involvement was required for student success. This same involvement needs to be embraced, appreciated, and ensured, even without a pandemic. As parents, we want to protect our children physically, emotionally, and from harm in general. Screening what they watch, hear, participate in, their friend choices are all things we do to protect them from developmentally inappropriate or sensitive materials or influences, and to keep them safe. Writing policy that prevents the teaching of sexual content before fourth grade protects children from developmentally inappropriate and sensitive material. Requiring written permission allowing for parents to preview an entire content of curriculum gives parents choice on their child's exposure to content at fourth grade and beyond. Our goal is to develop healthy, happy, contributing people. Parents who are a child's first and most important teacher. Our values and beliefs, the culture of the home and family, are foundational in raising our children to be confident, balanced, healthy adults. Providing transparency in education by providing access to all student records for parents when summoned supports parents making decisions about their child's health. Protecting these rights for parents by providing a course of action in the event of highly sensitive issues being mishandled helps to ensure compliance through the clearly written expectations for all involved within the education system. Communicating rising concerns or issues with children in the realm of identity and or sexual content informs parents about crucial incidences and sensitive topics for family discussion and possibly a need for families to seek outside support. We're underestimating our parents when we assume they would not want to know the struggles their children are having, except for in those rare cases, of course, and be able to support them. In addition, providing separation of restroom and locker room support shows support for student safety, ensuring both parents' student rights. Given my diverse experiences working in education, I've experienced firsthand student success as a result of parental involvement. Based on this experience, I believe parental rights should be a given and protected. And finally, this bill places matters of personal identification and sexual education directly in the hands of parents. Writing policy is proactive in protecting the rights of parents to designate the official name used by schools when addressing their enrolled child. It is my belief that the emphasis on preferred pronouns is a distraction to all, interfering and overshadowing the right to an education that prepares all students for success. This is a highly sensitive and complex and developmentally appropriate issue. It saddens me to think we have allowed our youth to diminish their value of who they are to a pronoun or to what they perceive as their sexuality. When did our sexuality become our identity? Our sexuality is merely a sliver of who we really are. We're much more than a he or she or sister's friends, artists, musicians, counselors, etc., hence my personal story shared earlier. I'm a daughter, a sister, a friend. We're so much more. This portion of the bill may provide the safety net needed for students who may be under pressure for acceptance or simply in need of attention, a basic human need, or for students who may need an adult to set boundaries for them to feel safe and give them the wherewithal to reflect on their own boundaries. Adults who know and understand the stages of development and developmental maturation of youth understand the need to protect students from harm until they reach a mature state developmentally. There's a reason for age limits for smoking, drinking, military service, voting, etc. It's about placing an age on these activities in order to protect and provide the best opportunity for youth to make informed decisions. There's evidence in studies that suggest that individuals who experience different diagnoses, perhaps, or like ADHD, mature emotionally even much later than their peers, sometimes as late as 28 years of age. In closing, our children should be able to count on us, supporting them in tough times and in good, ensuring parent rights to access information about their child's physical, medical, and mental health is our given right, would be counterproductive for various caregivers to not be on the same page for the overall well-being of the student. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. I wanted to acknowledge that Representative Galvin, and so has Representative Vance joined us today. We appreciate your testimony, and thank you very much for joining us from Wasilla. It looks like we do have Ms. Google on the line. Ms. Google, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Would you go ahead with your presentation, please?
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate being able to speak to the committee today. And I'm calling in to speak in favor of House Bill 105 as Governor Dunleavy has presented it. I am a retired teacher, and I want to say up front, I highly underscore everything that the previous speaker said. It was excellent. Yeah. I really appreciate listening to her. I am passionate about teaching. I kind of do it in any aspect of my life that I get involved in. And I've been doing that for my entire adult life. I want to see what Governor Dunleavy has proposed in the area of transparent access to curriculum, activities, and all records for their children in whatever school context they are in, as well as encouraging parental participation in their children's educational experience.
Ms. Google, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you please place your name on the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Christine Google. Would you like me to spell it?
I think we're okay. You can continue. Thank you.
Okay, I apologize. I'm a mom of seven. I'm a grandmother of 30 grand and great-grandchildren. I have a four-year degree in nursing. And I did teach my children at home. I have also taught in a public high school and participated in classrooms as my kids were in public education. I helped to establish and I taught and counseled in a 24/7 faith-based drug recovery program in Highland Mountain Correctional Center, Alaska's women's prison, for 12 and a half years. And in that role, I got to know lots and lots of the women. I communicated a great deal all over the population and kind of became a part of the community. So I developed trust with them. And that was the result of that period of time being highly impactful in my life. The ladies taught me so much about life from their view of what happens when life, home, family, sobriety, marriage, employment, virginity, all gets broken down. When the moral foundations crumble and there are no moorings of right and wrong, the most powerful thing in their lives that they told me about through countless occasions of tears was the factors that set the course of their future and still was their biggest pain even when they were incarcerated, and that was failure and breakdowns in the family. I'm saying this to say that parental involvement in children's lives is immeasurably important. The home and family needs to be considered part of the educational team. The family is one of the wisest educators' assets. A wise educator will make use of parents. I heard a reporter at the governor's press conference a week ago presented this bill that asked the question, what about teachers quitting because they feel suffocated or invaded? I can't remember what the exact word was, but when they felt suffocated by parents. And I asked myself, where on earth does this concept come from? As I exampled from even prisoners, family is critical to any child. Teachers are servants to the very highest goals of a nation, a state, a community, and family, providing much of the specialized instruction to children, giving them skills in reading, math, history, science, etc., so that they in turn may contribute their best to the overall welfare of society. And as such, teachers can become heroes, and they become heroes the best when they are supportive of the environment, the morals, and the value structure that the children are getting from their home. The parents know the very best for their child, and they know their child the best, and they alone have the God-given responsibility for the moral, spiritual, and sexual, medical condition of their children, and they alone will answer for these things as they carry out that responsibility. These things are not the purview of public education until or unless the parents request it to be so. These matters should always remain the choice of parents. The governor is endeavoring to protect that. Teachers are not parent replacements and should never view a parent as wanting to be, or a parent wanting to be involved as some form of invasion. Alaska admittedly has large regions where there are serious difficulties facing educators. There's no doubt about that. And my husband is from an Alaska Native village, and we lived in a village for a couple of years, so I'm well aware of this. In these regions, and not just in the villages, but there are other rural regions in Alaska where there's a large percentage of broken homes, divorce, domestic violence, physical, mental, sexual, and there's neglect. These things, I have learned, are called ACEs, or adverse childhood experience, that can negatively affect or even arrest a child's development. These all divide what a child naturally craves being intact, their family. These make it hard for children to do well in school. My point again here is that support of and regard for the importance of family involvement in education is very, very critical. It's not only critical and essential for the child's well-being and success in school, but in terms of the school districts of their needs, it is also cost-saving. I know that the governor is also promoting with his bills for education means with which to attract and retain more educators. Schools need to incorporate parents, bring parents into the classroom to help with reading, math, experiments, science, trips to the library, and other activities. I was involved in my children's classroom, and a couple of my daughters are presently involved in classrooms. It's a very important factor to the children. It's also a long-established and well-studied principle in education with proven results that when a child's parent participates in the classroom, the child does better at school. Parents can volunteer to fill some of the gaps where there's a teacher shortage or a financial shortage for programs, and the result will be twofold: better results with higher achievement for the children and lowered workload for the teacher and cost for the schools. Parents have become an underutilized, passive educational asset. When my kids were in school, parents were widely involved in our elementary school, teachers believed in it, and the kids loved it. School should not be a place where the teachers are pressuring children against their moral or spiritual upbringing. School should not be a place of indoctrination on matters of deviant sexual identity or behaviors or other such sensitive matters. This should never take place at school, and least of all in elementary or middle school. Nor should children be made to feel that they have to keep secrets about what is being said or done at school. In the prison, we call that a negative contract, and I can tell you from many experiences that keeping secrets like that will always cause an addict to relapse or a lady struggling with a behavior issue to fall. In adults, it is a huge stressor. If fear or confusion is voiced on a child by what is said in the classroom by a teacher, or if they feel division coming from family or separation with them from their family, they are going to view that as an ACE, one of those adverse childhood experiences. And in education, we just can't allow this. This can happen with gender questions, with the use of pronouns, with fear and uncertainty about bathrooms, and graphic exposure to images and content in books relating to sex in elementary school. I strenuously urge the passage of House Bill 105 and urge that the only amendments might include wording to encourage principals and teachers to incorporate parental assistance in each classroom routinely. It wasn't every day when I was involved because the WISE teachers rotated parents to give as many children in the classroom as they could a chance to have their mom or dad participate. The kids thrived. These were very successful and beloved teachers. So I highly encourage what the governor has presented. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you, Ms. Google, for your testimony. We appreciate you being here today. And I'm going to go ahead and open up questions to our committees, our committee members, if they have any. Does anybody have a question for the presenters?
I just have one quick one.
Sure. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question's for Ms. Google.
Please.
Ms. Google, have you ever been stopped from going into the public school to assist in a classroom?
No, I never had that experience. The classrooms were open, available. The principal encouraged it, and the teachers encouraged it. So when I was doing that, no, I never, ever experienced that. And one of my daughters is currently, she and her husband are frequently involved in their child's classroom. They are even called in if their young son has some struggles, and so they are frequently invited in. The principal supports it, and the teacher very much appreciates it.
Glad to hear that. Thank you.
No, thank you. Anybody else have any questions? Okay. Thank you. I'd like to ask, let's see here. We're going to go ahead and hold HB. Do you have any final comments before I hold over the bill?
Chair Allard, no, I don't have any final comments. Thank you.
Anything? Okay. Thank you. All right, we will hold HB 105 and revisit it during the meeting date to be determined in the future. And we're going to take a brief at ease. Thank you. Agenda item, an introduction to HB 21. I just want to put on the record, I apologize. My hearing devices aren't working properly, and I'm struggling right now to chair this, but we'll get through it. HB 21, School University Employee Health Insurance. I'd like to invite Representative Vance and her staffer, Chief of Staff Jake Almeida. Did I say that correctly? Thank you for being here. Welcome, and please put your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Ruffridge, and members of House Education Committee. There's so many microphones, I have to figure out which one.
Just a minute, Representative, could you just turn up the speakers just a smidge bit for us? Thank you, sir. Okay, go ahead, Representative Vance.
Well, thank you for hearing this bill today. It is no secret that school districts are facing challenges recruiting and retaining teachers and support staff that is compounded by the rising cost of health care. As a representative and wife of an elementary school custodian, I hear you. I know that many of you have likely heard of teachers and other people in the public who are looking for a different job simply because of the weight of healthcare, and perhaps they have a plan that is now has a higher cost of premium that has become a struggle. This is something that I'm hearing more and more of. This fall, as I attended my local school board meeting, is where I heard a teacher representative over health insurance plead with the school board to have an emergency meeting to discuss their health care because they were losing teachers. There had been a shift in our school district of a higher cost of premium for families. And as I sat there for a different purpose in the meeting, It was at that moment that I decided to bring back House Bill 21, School Healthcare Consolidation, as an option for the school district to pursue, should it be the will of the legislature to support and pass this concept. The bill has been offered and heard in prior legislatures before my time, but it was only offered as a forced requirement for all of the schools to consolidate under this, under the healthcare plan. This bill is distinctly different in that it supports local control and is 100% optional. According to the 2019 ICER research summary number 2019-4 titled, How Much Does Alaska Spend on K-12 Education? In the subsection, What Drives the Cost of Public Education in Alaska, it states that there's three Alaska exceptionalities that set us apart from other states in our education spending patterns. Small schools, healthcare, and energy. I don't know what it's like in your school district, but in mine, we face all three of these as challenges for the higher cost of education. Alaska has the highest cost per capita of healthcare in the United States. If you do a quick Google search asking who has the highest cost of healthcare in the world, the United States spends the most. So you could easily make the conclusion that Alaska bears the highest cost of healthcare in the world. And this is according to Gutabi as well, that I have stated on there. This obviously negatively affects private and public sectors of our economy because healthcare costs are part of teacher compensation. While the challenge of high healthcare costs is not unique to education, in a fixed budget scenario, these costs put downward pressure on wages, making it more difficult for Alaska districts to offer teachers a nationally competitive salary. My goal is to ease the financial burden of school districts and give the state of Alaska more leverage to negotiate with healthcare providers, improving services for Alaskans with the potential of saving millions of dollars. House Bill 21, the School University Health Insurance, amends current statute to provide the option for school districts, the University of Alaska, and governmental units such as cities and boroughs to participate in AlaskaCare, the state employee healthcare plan. These entities would have the choice to opt into the pool as an entire entity, enabling Alaska's Department of Administration to negotiate a better cost of healthcare. So what are the benefits of consolidation? There's three key areas that I've identified. And number one, it saves money. That's what we all like to hear in this building, and really within our school districts, is that it saves money. By expanding the number of participants in a healthcare pool, the potential for savings increases. This is a concept that we all understand. Most of our school districts are small and must carry this burden alone. Several school districts have responded favorably, and one has even reported potential savings of $7 million a year. They accounted that to be $3,000 of savings per employee. Previous estimates conclude a savings of at least $200 million per year if all the school districts chose to consolidate under the healthcare plan. While the amount of savings is determined by the number of participants, healthcare consolidation is an option worth pursuing. The second item that I've identified is that it provides more healthcare options. Some school districts are facing challenges shopping the market to find affordable healthcare due to high use members. This bill expands options with a larger pool to more easily offset the high users. The third area that I've identified is that it reduces staff burden. Schools who choose to consolidate will reduce staff burden of having to have a dedicated employee who's responsible for managing a healthcare plan. This flexibility will free up staff to focus on what matters most, providing a quality education for our children. The option of consolidation is intended to help reduce the cost of education, but I want to make it clear, this is also available to the University of Alaska and our local municipalities and boroughs. Each governmental unit can find a healthcare plan that fits their individual needs and budget by working together. So I would now like to defer to our invited testimony. Madam Chair, I would like to hear from Superintendent Randy Traney of the Matsu Borough School District for invited testimony.
Thank you. Representative Vance, for your presentation. Mr. Traney, are you on the line?
Yep. Yes, I'm here.
Can you go ahead with your comments, please?
All right. I don't have, I don't have a prepared statement other than to really emphasize that this is a bill that the Massey Borough School District is behind. As the representative mentioned, you know, at last look for all of our employees, if we could move all of our employee groups to this, and of course that would happen through collective bargaining, the difference between our current premiums, which range between $28,000 and $38,000 a year per employee, and the last look I had at the Alaska Care premiums, we could save between $6 and $7 million if, you know, if we were able to move all of our collective bargaining units to this plan. I think more importantly than that, because we all know that insurance rates change all the time and plans change all the time, what this would provide is competition and choice. And you know that when there's a monopoly on something, you never get the best price. If there are options for other healthcare options, that teachers and classified employees and principals can take advantage of, I think that we might see a reduction in rate hikes across our state. I just can't emphasize enough how important I think passing this bill is, because I don't see it as having any negative downsides. It only could provide a potential for savings for probably all of the districts in the state. I think that's all I really have to say. I do really appreciate that this is that you're considering this. I know that this has been one of the priorities of my school board for the last 3 years.
Thank you, Mr. Trainey, for your comments. Representative Vance, did you want to hear from Ms. Wood? Ms. Betsy Wood is on the line.
Madam Co-Chair, I would like to walk through the sectional, if that is your will, and then we can we have Ms. Wood, who's the healthcare administrator from the Department of Administration, available for any further questions.
Please go ahead, Representative Vance.
So we provided the committee a sectional analysis that we can walk through. I would just like to highlight a couple of things and to point out that this sectional analysis is a very detailed, it is not a generalized sectional, but overall the bill is very simple in that it allows the school districts and governmental units the option, but it does have the details on what that looks like. So in section one, it adds to the powers of regional school boards the power to establish and maintain the district participation in a policy in the group insurance. This is essentially saying that REAAs have the ability to opt in as well. Section two adds to the duties of school districts, and it says that they must cover the portion of their involvement in the healthcare policy. Section three allows the Commissioner of Administration to expend from the Public Education Fund to the Group Health and Life Benefits Fund a total of $100 million or less as needed to pay claims. This section is essentially the accounting portion that describes the mechanism of moving of the funds going from one to the other to the appropriate place. Section 4 is the meat of the bill that adds a new chapter that allows school districts to participate in a policy of insurance that provides medical coverage to state employees and to school district employees. And it goes into the further detail of what that looks like for the university and for the school districts. Section 5 allows the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska to establish and maintain that group of policy as well. Section 6 is speaking to the area that allows the governmental units, like our municipalities and our boroughs. And it also details, specifically outlines that the employee, spouse, and dependent children are also covered under this plan. Section 7 adds the University of Alaska the definition of a governmental unit. It was previously excluded under this chapter, and we want to make sure that that is included. Section 8 is the definition of a school district that is amended in 6 and 7. Section 9 authorizes the Department of Administration to provide group medical insurance coverage to school district employees and other government units by means of self-insurance. And what this means is that it allows the Department of Administration the ability to consolidate a school district or governmental unit under the Alaska Care Plan or have a separate self-insured plan if that's what works out best for that governmental unit. Section 10 requires the Department of Administration to procure excess loss insurance in connection with providing group medical insurance to employees of the governmental unit other than the state, and allows the department to allocate the costs within the excess loss insurance across all governmental units. Section 11 says that it will be applicable to collective bargaining agreements and other contracts that become legally binding on or after the effective date. And then the following sections are adopting regulations. And you'll notice that the regulation adoption and the effective date of the bill are a year different. And that is because this bill specifically says we're going to have the regulations in place before the bill takes effect for school districts to consolidate. So that gives the Department of Administration time to make sure everything is in order before they start onboarding the schools and governmental units. So I encourage you to take a look at those to have a better understanding. But we do have Ms. Wood online for any more detailed questions about the bill and how this would work.
Thank you very much, Representative Vance. Are there any questions from the committee? Go ahead, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Allard, and welcome, Rep. Vance, Mr. Almeida. Good to have some potential solutions out there for our high cost of health care to look at. I am wondering if you've had a chance to assess how many districts would be interested in returning to this or to this option.
Thank you, Representative Story, through the chair. We have been working with ALASBO to find out what the cost of healthcare is of each school district and to be able to reach out. We have emailed every school district and we've heard from a number of them, but I do not have a definitive number from you at this point.
Follow up?
Correct. Go ahead.
Yes, through the chair. The same with the teachers' organization. I know that Mr. Trainee testified that it would be through collective bargaining that they would, you know, possibly move to this if it was agreeable. Have you discussed with leadership there and their interest in this?
Through the chair, Representative Story, we've been working with the school board administrators, and they have been having discussions, but as far as our conversation with them directly, no, we have not done that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any question? Oh, Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Representative Vance. I think this is a very novel solution. I'm excited to dig into this. I noticed that there wasn't any fiscal notes anywhere for this one. Is that forthcoming at some point? Or it seems like potentially the department or commissioner or administration would have some sort of cost associated with maybe expanding their role or adding staff of some sort. Is that something you can speak to?
Co-Chair Ruffridge, we just received the fiscal notes. I noticed them in my email last night, so they must have come over the weekend, and we will be forwarding those on soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Okay, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I just want to, I guess, confirm publicly that currently governmental units other than the state are not allowed to participate in the state employees' health plan. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, that is correct. When I previously worked on this bill, one of the issues in working with legislative legal was that this area of statute needed further defined so that governmental units could participate. And this last year, because our Kenai Peninsula borough did express interest, I called again to our legal division and asked for clarification if they could opt in, and the answer was no, not until passage of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up. And there was no mention. It's a one-sided agreement. There is no mention of underwriting standards or anything like that. In other words, the state's employee insurance plan would have to accept other groups and would not have the option of not accepting them. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I believe that is correct, but I believe Ms. Wood would be able to better speak to that.
Okay.
Ms. Wood, would you like to respond, please, to Representative Prox's question?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Betsy Wood. I'm the Chief Health Administrator with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the chair, Representative Prax, that's my reading of the bill as well, that the way as it's written, the division and the Department of Administration would be required to accept any governmental unit or school district that wanted to participate.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up?
Thank you. Follow-up.
Have we explored the option of individual school, well, let me think about this. I guess currently the district health plans, I suppose there's some that are provided through the district and others that are provided through a bargaining unit. And have we explored the option of allowing districts to form their own cooperative agreement, one district to another? Just more options available to them.
I believe that's directed to Ms. Wood, right? I think that's directed to you, Ms. Wood.
Yeah, whoever would have thought about that.
thank you, through the chair, Representative Prax. I actually would defer perhaps to the bill sponsor that, you know, my purview is really the coverage for the through the Alaska Care Health Plan, and as far as the current coverage for school districts, and what's been explored and potential options out there really falls outside the scope of what I would be responsible for, unfortunately.
Sure. Representative Vance, we have Andrea, Ms. Andrea Mecca, I'm trying to pronounce her name, with Health Operations. Is that somebody that could answer this question for Mr. Prox? No.
Co-Chair Allard, I'm unfamiliar with her, but I do know, Representative Prox, through the chair, that Alaskan Municipal League has offered an option for municipalities to be able to have a group health insurance under something that they provide in order to help ease this burden for local governments. So that may be answer part of your question.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another follow-up, Mr. Representative Prox? No?
No.
Okay. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, that $7 million is an impressive number. So I don't know if Mr. Traney is still with us, but how is that calculated? How do we, like, how does this save money? How does it work?
Mr. Traney is not on the line anymore. Is he back on? Okay. Let me see. Oh. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Traney. Can you answer that for Representative Hemshoot, please?
Yeah, that number it's pretty easy to calculate. You take the premium that we're paying and the premium of Alaska Care and multiply it times our number of employees. And so that was number was based off several years ago when I did the calculation. And like I said, premiums change all of the time. So I'm not sure what the savings would be right now. I do know that our average premium that we're paying currently is between $28,000 and $30,000 a year per employee. I was trying to find the new Alaska Care number this morning. I just couldn't come to a number that I thought was accurate. But I think your staff could do that math pretty easy.
Thank you. Representative Hemshoot has a follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair, whoever could arrange for that, I'd love to get the current numbers. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ruffage.
Thank you, Chair Allard. Through the chair, I guess this would probably be to Mr. Traney as well, or to the bill sponsor. I'm really surprised by the number that I just heard, about 28,000 to 30,000 per employee. I'm assuming that that is the cost for the employee and family, because if it is just the employee for health coverage, that would be a wild number. Could you confirm that?
Yeah, that's family coverage, and that, you know, there are several different plans that our employees can choose from, and we have four bargaining units, so I'm giving you the 100,000 foot view. But the vast majority of our employees have several plans to choose from, and the total cost of those plans for family coverage is between $28,000 and $30,000 a year. That counts the employee version that they pay in premiums, as well as the district's version, a portion of premiums each year.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, I must be confused. The purpose of this is to add choice, but you just said they have a lot of choice. So is that plans within one insurer? This is for Mr. Trainer.
Yeah, through the chair, if I may. So in Matt Sue's case, our two largest groups are teachers and are classified. They're covered by the Public Employee Health Trust. And within the trust menu of plans, there's like a high cost deductible plan and then a more Cadillac plan, and then others in between those two extremes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other committee members who have questions? Oh, Representative Prox, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, not sure who wants to answer this or has thought about it, but has anyone done a second and third and fourth iteration of what happens when you work with great big insurance companies? They look at the immediate and then they try to predict into the future. If your actuarial standards change, it creates incentives for certain groups over another. And you have to do several iterations. You can't just say it works in the short run. You have to look at how it works in the long run. The classic example is, what we refer to as Obamacare and Medicaid and Medicare. When you centralize and provide different incentives. Has anyone checked into what happens next?
This is for Mr. Trainee.
I don't know. I'm thinking it would be Ms. Wood, the insurance, state insurance person.
Thank you for the record, Bessie Wood with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the chair, you know, you're right. That's the type of analysis you'd want to kind of take a look at. What does it look like if different groups were to come into a plan, and then what does that look like out into the future? That type of actuarial analysis is typically something that we would do when a bill approaches the Finance Committee to get a better sense of those longer range impacts, but it's certainly something that we're looking ahead to.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other committee member? Representative Story, please.
Thank you, Chair. This would be to Ms. Wood.
Go ahead.
I believe there was a study done in 2021 through Retirement and Benefits about the university system joining Alaska Care, and they said that it was, I don't know if the cost neutral or there wouldn't be any savings because the cost of the university switching to such a plan negates costs. I don't know if I'm getting that right, but if you were part of that dive into that, I would appreciate your perspective.
Certainly, through the chair, you know, the division did take a look at kind of, I guess, more than a cursory look at what it would look like for the university to be provided that opportunity. And I'd have to go back and take a look before I can tell you exactly, but your recollection is correct that I think that there were some minor savings, but not significant. And so I think that at that point we decided to kind of put that idea down at the time. A lot of it has to do with, you know, differences in plan design, that the university system has different plan options than the current Alaska Care employee plan. So you have to adjust for the differences in plan design, and then you also look at that kind of per employee per month cost and see where those kind of cost comparisons would be. But your general sense is correct that it was mostly a wash looking at having the university system enter the Alaska Care program at that time. However, as has been noted earlier in the conversation, change year to year, premiums can change year to year, and so really every year is kind of a new dawn that you can take a look at changing circumstances, and what may not have been particularly attractive at one point in time could become very attractive the next year.
Thank you, Representative Story. That's it? Okay, thank you. Is there any more questions? Representative Prox.
Oh, just a comment. We need to look at this very carefully. Personal experience. About a decade or so ago, I was involved with selling individual insurance policies, and I had to buy an individual insurance policy. And you can't, there is no apples to apples complete comparison. There's only choices. But at that point, my individual family policy was costing me about half of what the state's group policy was costing it if you figured it down to the individual level. And so you, it looks good on the surface, but you really have to think carefully about this. Insurance is an odd business.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Prox. And Representative Vance, I will let you have the last closing comments.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. And to the point, Representative Prox, I just want to reiterate that this allows the option for school districts, the University of Alaska, and governmental units to choose so that they can look at what works for their individual unit of whether it would be beneficial to join the healthcare plan or not. It does not require them to join. And as Ms. Wood previously stated, every year is a new year when it comes to healthcare. And so far, what we've seen over the past number of years is that those healthcare costs are rising. And the more options that we have as Alaskans, the better we will be able to address these. And overall, the goal right now is to ease the financial strain on our school districts and the downward pressure on our education budget so that schools can focus on what matters most, and that's providing a quality education to our children. Thank you, Vice Chair, our Co-Chair Allard, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Okay, well, we will hold HB 21 and revisit it during a meeting date to be determined in the future. Thank you very much for being here with us and for your presentations today. That concludes our business of the day. On Wednesday, there will be a joint House Senate Education Committee meeting to hear Alaska State Board of Education report to the legislature fiscal year 2023. Seeing no other business before this committee, we will be adjourned. Let the record reflect that it is 9:24.